On this podcast, we discuss medical diagnoses and procedures. All of the guests express their own opinions. You should always seek medical advice from a trained and credentialed professional when making decisions about your own health. Welcome to the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast. I'm Emma Cooksey, and I've been coping with sleep apnea since childhood. I didn't know anyone in my life with a sleep disorder, so I decided to start this podcast. I'm here to build community and provide a platform for people with sleep apnea to tell their stories. Together, we can shatter stereotypes and raise awareness. We'll be exploring all sorts of treatment options and lifestyle choices to help you live your best life with sleep apnea. This is Sleep Apnea Stories, and I'm so glad you're here. Hey there, it's Emma Cooksey here, and I'm your host. So if you're listening to this right when it comes out, I have a couple of speaking things coming up. So this coming Saturday, it's going to be the 30th of September, I'm speaking at a virtual PCOS conference. It's called PCOS Con. It's run by the PCOS Awareness Association, so they're all about raising awareness about polycystic ovarian syndrome. And I was really keen to speak at this because I haven't really talked a lot on here about it, but I had PCOS definitely during my 20s, and obviously also have sleep apnea. If you're interested to hear that talk, you can still register, I think. I'll put the link in the show notes so that you guys can go and register there if you're interested. There's lots of other speakers, it's not just me. So the whole day is all about different aspects of PCOS, and I'm just talking about the sleep apnea part. So I'm excited about that. And then the next week, I'm going to be in Myrtle Beach at the Carolina Sleep Society. So they very kindly invited me to speak from a patient perspective about the power of patient stories. So I'm excited for that. That's going to be a lot of different sleep techs. And I just think it's so helpful to share different perspectives so that, you know, we can kind of move things forward in sleep medicine, you know, like paying attention to what is important to patients. The other thing is, it's really nice to have my workbook, the 6-week CPAP Solutions workbook, is now out in the world, and people are ordering it. It's really exciting. And if you have ordered it already, I would love to hear your feedback, like which parts were particularly helpful. Is there anything missing that I can include in future editions? Thank you so much to everybody that's ordered that. So the one of the things I keep getting asked about is if there's going to be an ebook version, and I think there is, but I need to figure out the best way to do that. So I'm going to be nerding out about ebooks and what the best way to format it is. And the other thing a lot of people are asking about is it going to be translated into different languages? And so I do have plans for that. I just would like to be able to adapt it for the different countries, right? Because a lot of it is about having sleep apnea in America. So I want to look at like the different healthcare systems and maybe just like make some edits around that so that it's relevant for your country. But for now, people pretty much all over the world, you can go to the Amazon in your country and type in the 6-week CPAP Solutions workbook or just my name, Emma Cooksey, and you should be able to find it and order it from your Amazon. Today, I'm joined by Lindsay Scola, who is a keynote speaker, writer, producer, and strategist, who leads at the nexus of entertainment and political change. With over 20 years on core teams of high-powered, influential leaders across media, entertainment, politics, and government, she is passionate about expanding patient advocacy and normalizing conversations about sleep disorders. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Lindsay Scola. So Lindsay Scola, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I get to like be like, like first time caller, long time listener.
Yeah, and also it's worth saying that we're actual friends. Why don't you start off by just setting the scene of where you grew up, a little bit about where you're from, where you live now, those kind of things. Oh, maybe about your exciting job as well.
Well, that's how much time do I have? I mean, that's the whole podcast.
You
So
can
I
do a little cheeky 5 minute,
Oh,
give
well,
people a
now
taster.
challenge accepted. Okay. 5 minutes. I grew up in Seattle, and West Coast kid, love being outside. Really got into mountain climbing when I was in high school. Found out that I had an issue with altitude sickness, which made that slightly challenging, but always up for a challenge. But also really, really love politics. And I staged my first walkout when I was in first grade over unfair treatment in the lunchroom.
So even as a child, you love politics.
Oh yeah, I came out of the womb that way. I mean, like I'm ready for a debate at all times, much to my parents' chagrin. There was a lot of times where they came to release me from the principal's office. And I took that with me, that spirit, to Washington, D.C. My first job out of college was working for a congressman. And it was a particularly difficult Congress for any political nerds in the audience. The 105th Congress was a little bit challenging. So in 2007, I quit my job, bought a car, and moved to Iowa to work for then Senator Barack Obama. I am a Jew from Seattle, so my first time in Iowa was with my super forester full of my belongings. But I very deeply fell in love with Iowa, and Iowa City particularly has a very special place in my heart, and was there for a year working on the Iowa caucuses, and that turned into working on the advance staff for Senator Obama, and then working on presidential advance for President Obama and working in the administration. And then decided it was time to work in entertainment. So I moved to LA.
Move to LA,
Moved to, why not?
as you
Well,
do.
as one does. I really like big cross country moves. I mean, like, don't go short moves. There's got to be multiple thousands of miles in the middle of that. Yeah, came out here in 2016 to work for the Emmys. I was the head of talent relations there. Love being in charge of a red carpet. And had this moment of really feeling why I was so drawn to entertainment is this connection between entertainment and advocacy, and that what we see on TV really pulls hearts and minds in a completely different way than politics does, and that we've got all this very sort of special access when we create characters that are in people's living rooms, and a responsibility around that people are able to have conversations and see things that they wouldn't normally see in their everyday and not feel judged about it, and really open hearts and minds in a different kind of way. And in the last
Love
couple of
it.
years, thank you. In the
Oh,
last
last
couple
couple of years.
of years,
Go
I've
ahead,
gone out on my
and
own.
then we'll get super into sleep.
Yes. I started working on my own, and so now I work at the intersection of entertainment and advocacy, working with nonprofit organizations on how we tell stories differently in the cultural space. Whether if that's working with celebrities on a campaign, or working with media in a different kind of way, or working with TV writers' rooms, and sort of owning the space here in the mushy middle where we can make very cool things happen.
So now what I wanted to do was go back and talk a little bit about when I know that you went undiagnosed for a long time. So I wondered how you remember your experience of sleep, like as a child, as a teenager. Like I know sometimes things look different in retrospect when you're looking back, but can you take us through a little bit, like what was your relationship with sleep? Did you think that you had issues as a child or a teenager, or you just thought you were like everybody else? What was your thoughts about it?
I mean, I'm sure it's been a very similar thing for you as well when you like are in the sleep journey after a diagnosis, and then you start like it's like a murder board on like the TV show or the detective where you're like, oh, and then this thing happened and then this thing happened. And of course, when you're in that moment, you're never like piecing all these things together. So I've never been far from sleep. I mean, my whole life I've very easily fallen asleep, whether that was if in a car when someone else was driving, or I thought that I had this like superpower at airports if a flight was delayed that I could just lay down on the ground and go to sleep. Didn't realize just how special that was. And so that's really always been a thing. And so in terms of my narcolepsy diagnosis, the first time I talked to my doctor about feeling excessively sleepy, I was 16, and she told me that I was busy, and I did. I had a crazy schedule. I was in lots of extracurriculars, and she said busy people are tired. And so I sort of dismissed or repressed this feeling very early on, thinking that sort of everybody who did a lot of things felt that way.
And
And
were a lot of your friends who were also overachievers talking a lot about being tired?
I don't remember so much when I was a teenager. I definitely remember that in my early 20s, working on campaigns and like,
Yeah,
worked 20 hours.
everyone's exhausted.
Everyone's tired.
Yeah.
But not knowing what the definition of your tired versus my tired is, and thinking
Yes.
that my tired feels the same way as your tired.
Right.
And so not having a language to sort of understand the differences in what that could be, I just started to feel like I was failing. Because if you're saying
Yeah.
you're tired and I'm saying I'm tired and I feel this terrible and I look this terrible and you don't, that
Yeah.
means you're able to keep up better than I can.
Right.
And so I didn't have any way of knowing that there was a chance that my tired was different. And so that played out for me over and over again until I finally got diagnosed at 35.
And that's such a great way to articulate that. Like, I think that sleep disorder tired versus, the tired that everybody else is talking about is a different thing. And so it's helping people to understand that and to really parse out like what's going on with their sleep. And if, it's just that they're doing too much or that they're sleep deprived or whether they actually have a diagnosable sleep disorder. So
Yeah. And I think when you
when
combine
did
that, especially like working in politics, where, you on a campaign, you sort of watch everybody after like 8 o'clock at night, where they're like watching the person next to them is like, is anyone else like checking out? Like, I don't see anybody else leaving. So everyone's sort of like pushing themselves to work a little bit later and later and
Yeah.
later. And so
And I
you're
think
sort
it can be
of
the
feeling.
same in like corporate environments, right? It's like,
Absolutely.
who's going
Absolutely.
home? Nobody's going
Yeah.
home. I guess we're still staying.
Yeah, no, it becomes like you're as good as the quantity, not necessarily looking at the quality. And so if you're the last person to leave and the first person to get there, like it's about the sheer hours you're putting in. And so when everybody's sort of in that hamster wheel, it's really hard to decipher like what of this is this moment and what of this am
Yeah.
I physically bringing to this with me?
So you went to the doctor at 16 to talk about your sleep. Were there other periods where you went back to the doctor and said, still dealing with a lot of sleepiness, or you just buckled down and just got on with all your jobs?
I mean, a combination of both, right? Is, that would come up. And like any sort of autoimmune condition or things that sort of ebb and flow, is there's times where it's better and there's times when it's worse. And so the times when it's worse, you're like really buckle down that I'm going to find an answer to this. And in my case, I went to DC out of school and moved around on campaigns and in the administration and was back and forth between DC and Chicago and New York. So I had a different doctor all the time. So I was really, every time it was worse, I was sort of
Yeah.
starting over. And the thing, with narcolepsy is that there's five distinct symptoms that really don't have a lot of connection between each other. So when you're really focused on one and you're seeing a new doctor, you're not looking at all of those pieces of the puzzle coming together for a doctor to necessarily notice a pattern in that, if they
Right.
even can. And we know
So
that.
for so a lot of people listening have sleep apnea or upper airway resistance syndrome, those kind of things, but m might not know a lot about narcolepsy. So, how were narcolepsy symptoms showing up in your life? Were you just missing things as just being, I don't know, like bad dreams or nightmares when actually now you know that there's some symptoms that explain
Oh,
that?
Yeah, no, I thought that I had really vivid nightmares for a long time, and I did bring that up with doctors, but I had a stressful job, and so that was really easily dismissed as nightmares. But I didn't have language to understand that it was a hallucination.
Yeah.
And so I was hallucinating. And, you know, even now when people talk about hallucinations, even when sleep doctors talk about hallucinations, it's really about the visual of hallucinations, you know, sort of pink elephants floating across the room.
Yes.
Most of my hallucinations are audio. It's things that I hear. I do have visual hallucinations, but they're few and far between. Now that I can decipher between a vivid dream and a hallucination,
So
they're
you're
really.
hearing things that aren't there, but they feel very real to you.
Oh, absolutely. And it can be anywhere from, you know, me being woken up in the middle of the night by a ghost child asking to hold my hand, which I definitely thought that my house was haunted. I lived in
Yeah.
a 1920s bungalow in Echo Park, so I think it was a yes and situation on the haunting. I never considered
We're not ruling out that it could have actually been haunted as well as
it
the
could have been both.
narcolepsy.
I purchased Sage, never considered neurological episode. But you know, they're also the total mundane of hearing construction happening in the backyard that's not there, or hearing people speaking in a
Oh.
language in the hallway that aren't there. I have a 3.5 month old puppy who I regularly hear crying in the middle of the night, who is fast asleep. I hear my significant other speaking to me in the middle of the night and like roll over, and he is fast asleep. So, you know, they can be super mundane things, and they can also be, you know,
It's
on a
still kind of disturbing, though,
oh,
but
absolutely.
more so if you don't know what it is.
100%. I know what it is. I can say, oh, I just hallucinated, and I can roll back over and go to sleep. I never
Yeah.
thought I'd be so comfortable with that. But when you don't know what it is, and you sort of bring it up in the language that you have, which for me was a night terror, it was really easily dismissed. And then at a certain point, I just thought I was a little crazy, which again, not ruling that part out, but you know, never associated it as a potential
Yeah.
issue with sleep disorder. I also went to doctors multiple times about fractured sleep, which is a symptom of narcolepsy, where I was awake, you know, I'd fall asleep fine, but then wake up around 2 or 3 and then be up for a couple of hours and could not go back to sleep no matter what I did. And maybe get 15, 20 minutes of sleep before I had to wake up and go to work. And I had one doctor who was sure that, you know, I was making this complaint on the West Coast, and she was sure because I'd been on the East Coast before that it was just my body was set at a different time. You know, another doctor who said that it was absolutely stress, and that stress can make you wake up in the middle of the night and not be able to go back to sleep. And you know, people with narcolepsy just don't get deep sleep, or really struggle to. And so I was falling asleep fine. I was exhausted. But then when you wake up for half the night and then you're exhausted during the day, it's also easy to push that back on the fact that you were up for half the night.
So it sounds like a lot of the doctors that you went to didn't have a lot of training in spotting narcolepsy, which I think is true across a lot of sleep
No training.
disorders.
Yes.
No
Yeah.
training. Yeah.
Yeah, no,
So,
except for one doctor I've had since I've been diagnosed, I've had to explain what narcolepsy was to all of my GPs.
yeah. It's pretty similar. Like sleep apnea is a lot more common than narcolepsy, but even with sleep apnea, a lot of doctors I've had to share a lot of information with them because they're just not trained in it at all. So what were your perceptions of, I just find it really interesting what you're saying in the beginning about media portrayals of sleep disorders. What were your perceptions? Did you have any idea of what narcolepsy was? And what kind of ideas did you have, and where did that come from?
The movie Deuce Bigalow, Male Gigolo.
Right. I've heard that
Heard of
so
the
many times. That's
one
literally what
called
I
Big
think of too.
Parachute. So
Yeah.
I literally looked at my doctor when he told me I had narcolepsy, and I was like, "I'm sorry, I don't think you're right. I've never fallen asleep into a bowl of soup."
Right.
And
Because
explained to
that's
me
all
that's
we
what
know about it,
narcolepsy was,
right?
but
Which is,
yeah,
or
it was all
think
I
we
knew.
know.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it was all I knew. So even when I was, and like, look, I love an internet rabbit hole, and I will research myself to the ends of the internet, and I have found the ends multiple times. Never got to narcolepsy, because the things that I thought were happening to me were none of the terms that I would find
Yes.
around narcolepsy. And even if I had found my way to narcolepsy, I had this image of what narcolepsy was, And so I never would have even put those two things together.
So you
And
said you finally got a diagnosis in your 30s. So what was it that finally got you to that having a sleep test in order to, get your diagnosis with narcolepsy?
So this actually wasn't my first sleep study. I had a sleep study when I was 27. My mom and my sister were visiting me in my itty bitty tiny apartment in New York. It was 300 square feet. I said it had the most efficient bathroom in America because the tub, the sink, and the toilet all touched each other. So really could have done everything at once if you wanted to. But if you're sharing an apartment that size with two other people, they can hear everything. And I was talking in my sleep, and not just like a mumble. Like they knew that I was on a date. I was asking my date questions. I was answering questions about myself. I had recently been diagnosed with celiac disease, and I turned down the bread basket, which everyone thought was particularly sad that even in my dreams I can't eat gluten. And then my mom was just hoping she didn't hear the end of the date. So I went to the doctor. I was like, this is not normal. And she agreed. She was like, this is not normal. And so she sent me for just a regular sleep study. And it came back and said that I didn't have sleep apnea, which
Right.
that would
So
never be a symptom of sleep apnea.
explain to people who don't know anything apart from, I think that having that overnight portion where they're just really looking for sleep apnea and trying to decide if you have sleep apnea or not. But tell everybody about what that next part during the day is. Or maybe, tell us how you got to the diagnosis like in your 30s then.
Yeah, absolutely. So
Yeah, you had to myself.
I had
So you
this.
didn't have sleep apnea at
So I
that
did not
point.
have sleep apnea, and she sort of sent me on my way. And so that was 8 years before I got my diagnosis.
Oh,
So
wow. Okay.
fast forward to 35, and I've fought different issues about sleepiness in these 8 years. At 33, a doctor told me that that's what getting older felt like. Which now that I'm in my 40s, would like to go back and have 33 back. But okay, I'd like 33 back, but with the narcolepsy medication, if we can make those two things happen.
And also, just with the added wisdom and knowing yourself better and being able to say no more.
100%. Isn't that great when you hit 40? The being able to say no and the added wisdom. Anyway, so 35 comes along. I start having these bouts of super excessive sleepiness that I would feel otherwise engaged, and then it would just
Hit
punch me
you.
in the face, and I would feel like I was just exhausted from my head to my toes. And like, if I don't go to sleep right now, I'm gonna die. And these would hit me when I was in like very public meetings. This is when I'm working at the Emmys, and so I would like excuse myself and take short naps in the bathroom. I go to my doctor and I say, this can't be normal that I'm sleeping in the
Yeah.
bathroom multiple times a day, multiple days a week. And she's like, all right, we'll send you for a sleep study. Now, the insurance had changed at this point. So now they were giving the home sleep study as like the first line. So I
Yes.
go home and I wire
So
myself up.
common.
Results come back and I get a note back, says it's not sleep apnea. I
Right.
was apoplectic at this point because
Yes.
I was so tired. It had to be something. And really, the only sleep disorder I'd ever heard of was sleep apnea. My sister has sleep apnea, so thought, okay, maybe it's genetic, and like this is the thing that I have.
Yeah.
I went home. I drank an entire bottle of red wine, and I ate a pint of Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia, and went on a really thorough exhausting of the internet, and found out that the at-home sleep studies were developed by the VA as a low-cost alternative for overweight middle-aged men. And I was like, here, this is it. This is not me. And
Right. So home testing like definitely has a place, like especially for people who are more severe with sleep apnea, the doctor's pretty sure they have it. It's a great way to quickly confirm that. But as far as, the myriad of other sleep disorders, it's not really that helpful.
well, and it's just, it's fine if that is literally the first thing. And then if that
Yes.
comes back negative and there's still issues
So,
presenting, that we go to step two.
yes.
So
But
in
that
my
tends
case,
to take quite a lot of patient advocating for themselves
oh
to.
no, this is me literally coming back to my doctor with my stack of research. And as I'm like getting ready to make my dissertation to her about why this test was not designed for me, she acquiesced and said, we are now beyond both of our education on sleep, which is true. Most doctors have between 1 and 2 hours of education on sleep. We're talking that like they went to a sleep seminar one day while they were in med school for an hour or two. And so you and I are far more qualified to diagnose someone with sleep disorder than the majority of doctors of that you and I have had or that anyone listening to this podcast has. And so she finally said, let's send you to a sleep specialist. And I mean, I've been complaining now about this for 19 years in some way, shape, or form. And finally, someone's like, all right, let's send you to a sleep specialist. But I'm like having a toddler level meltdown on the floor of my doctor's office to get to the place. So I go to see him. When narcolepsy is particularly bad and you're not medicated, not everyone, me specifically, I lose total control of my emotions. I would classify myself at this point in my life as a lunatic zombie. So I did not have an appointment with my sleep specialist until I was multiple months into medication that didn't involve me like crying so hard I needed to be handed a paper bag to breathe into. And I was trying to convince him that I had sleep apnea, to which he was like, you don't have sleep apnea, but let's look at what else it could be. So
But
it's
just
actually
because you know there's something wrong with your sleep, and that's all you're really aware
that's all I
of,
knew.
so
And so it was like, I need answers. And I have decided that this is sleep apnea because that was the only thing that I ever heard of. I had no idea there were any sleep disorders. There was the one that I'd heard
or
of.
that you could have multiple at the same time, which we'll get to.
We'll get to that one. So the for people who are not familiar with a more extended sleep study, you actually end up getting two sleep studies at one time. But they keep you wired up to all the same stuff. So you have your overnight. That overnight, it's looking at your breathing and your brain and what's happening when you sleep. Wake you up early in the morning around like 6 a.m. And then 5 times over the course of the day, they come in and ask you to take a 30-minute nap. And they're judging how fast you fall asleep, and how fast you go into REM sleep. And people with narcolepsy fall asleep very quickly and also go into REM sleep uncharacteristically quickly as compared to someone with narcolepsy. They sent me home in 4 out of the naps. I didn't even get to stay for all the naps, so I probably should have known that there was something at that point, but I'm very good at compartmentalizing and was super surprised when I got my diagnosis.
So you went back to the sleep specialist, and were you like in the office having a chat in order
Oh
to get
yeah.
your diagnosis? Okay. And so what did you think?
I mean, I was just sort of dumbfounded. Like, I had spent so much time trying to find my own answers at this point that I didn't expect to be like taken off guard. That I think someone could have told me I had some sort of rare ear cancer at this point, and it would have felt more normal in this situation than narcolepsy. It was just that concept felt so foreign, and narcolepsy felt like the sort of like old-timey Charlie Chaplin sort of disorder. Like it didn't feel like something that like I could have. And also it didn't, there was no, I have I'm a collector of autoimmune conditions. So some people collect, records or like Hummel figurines. I collect autoimmune conditions. And I have Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, and I take a pill every morning for my thyroid, and I never have to think about my thyroid. And so when I got the narcolepsy diagnosis, like, okay, what's the pill that makes me again? And there is no novel treatment for narcolepsy. So you sort of try different things until you find something that works for right now.
To
I will.
manage the symptoms, but they're not at the point with the research where they can really target the underlying cause. They're more managing symptoms like stimulants during the day.
Yeah, and then you just hope that they do more good on managing the symptoms than the side effects on the medications. So at this point, I'm on medication combo 15 in 5 years. So yeah, I think that was I all of that was sort of the hardest thing to swallow. Was like it wasn't okay, we got an answer, here's the solution. And you talk about what you see on TV, someone goes to the doctor, they find out what it is, it's treated, it's gone. And so it's taken me so long to get an answer. And the answer is really we know what it is. But this is definitely by no means a solution that you never have to think about this ever again.
So how did you feel emotionally about that?
I did a lot of grieving. I did a lot of grieving, because you have things in your mind for what your life is going to look like, for better or for worse. I've always been somebody who life has been what's been happening for me while I've been making other plans, but you have a picture in your mind of what things are going to be like. And when I got that diagnosis, like, I wasn't gonna be the me again that I'd been looking for. I wasn't gonna be the person that I thought I was gonna be. I'm somebody who's a real open book about everything in my life. And at this point, somebody who needed to sleep a lot, didn't have a lot of control over their need to sleep a lot. I thought people were really gonna judge me, and I didn't wanna talk about it. I didn't want anyone to know. And so that was also a super bizarre feeling for me of not wanting to share this with people. I mean, it turns out that one of the best things for my mental health at this point has been talking about this and making sure that the next person doesn't go 19 years.
Yeah, same, definitely.
But getting to
I had a
harder.
similar experience of the grief of having a long time to diagnosis, and then also just a feeling of, I don't know anyone in my life with something like this. I don't really want to talk about it. Whereas I think, getting to the point where all I do is talk about it has been really excellent for my mental health. And just in terms of like the people that I've met and the opportunities I've had. So I'm glad that you're on my team of doing that. Are you a new or struggling CPAP user? Are you waking up and flinging your CPAP mask across the room in frustration? Maybe you have mask leak, skin irritation, or wake up with a dry mouth. You might be dealing with uncomfortable trapped gas from swallowing air or hair breakage from your headgear. If any of this sounds familiar, I made a workbook just for you. The 6-week CPAP Solutions Workbook is out now. It's just 30 pages and has been designed to give you all the answers to the most common CPAP problems. CPAP isn't for everyone, and I hear way too many stories of people abandoning their CPAP and leaving it on a shelf or in a closet. The workbook includes a 6-week tracker that lets you see progress over time. And if CPAP therapy isn't going well for you, you can return to your doctor and show them that you've given CPAP therapy your best effort and ask about other treatment options. To order the 6-week CPAP Solutions Workbook, follow the link at sleepapneastories.com or find the link in the show notes. You said that you had all sorts of different drug combinations and you're still kind of figuring that out. When did you start to think that maybe there was a sleep disorder breathing part to this? Like, was that, really recently, or when did you start questioning that?
Well,
You'd
so
already tested negative for sleep apnea in the home tests, right?
I had the sleep study test when I was 27. I had the home test when I was 35. That got followed up. I had two more tests in the sleep center when I was, on my way to my narcolepsy diagnosis. So I've had multiple things that told me that I did not have a breathing disorder. But I've actually always held my breath in my sleep, and my family all knows that. It wasn't like a consistent thing that would happen a lot, but when I did, it was like always traumatic enough that everybody would talk about it. I think my mom talked to a pediatrician at one point who mentioned that I started breathing again, and so they weren't overly concerned. One time when I was in college, I was backpacking with a friend who heard me stop breathing. And she was just sort of like thinking, like, what does she do next? Like, we were at a place with like not very good cell phone reception. Like, it was like the late 90s. So like, did she like hike up higher on the hill to get better cell phone reception to try to get help? Try to like hike down with my body, that wasn't breathing anymore. By the time she like, got closer to answers, I started breathing again. But this is sort of always been there. When I got the narcolepsy diagnosis, I sort of stopped thinking about those pieces because I had an answer on my sleep.
I think that is so, like, it's so funny you said that, Lindsay, because everybody I talk to is the same. And I was just talking to Michael Granier about this on last week's episode, where whenever somebody gets a diagnosis with a sleep disorder, whether it's sleep apnea or something else, it's like that gives you an answer. So anything to do with your sleep, you're like, well, it has to be because of that. Whereas actually, there's this all, not only can you have other sleep disorders, you also can deal with a whole bunch of other stuff that the general population that doesn't have sleep disorders deals with their sleep as well. So it's just an interesting thing. So you just thought, well, I have narcolepsy, so that's obviously what's going on.
And with narcolepsy, you can have parasomnia sometime, which is when you act out something in your in a dream. So maybe the way I was talking in my sleep, and that was like me holding my breath, like maybe I was like underwater in a dream. And so you try to talk yourself through all these things. And just because you don't have sleep apnea doesn't mean that you cannot have apneas that are happening. You just don't meet a certain threshold that the general medical industry slash insurance has decided is sleep apnea.
Which is really, when you think about it, very arbitrary. Like somebody just, they had to just set some standard, right? So they decided the pauses
Which
have to be 10 seconds and there have to be this many of them per hour in order to get a diagnosis of sleep apnea, and also
and I'm
this
gonna guess
many
that
per
that was
hour.
for men.
Right. Well, it definitely, that's what we're coming up against now, I think, with a lot of women who have lower AHIs, but have really pretty severe symptoms and aren't being given any treatment options because the insurance company won't pay for CPAP because they don't consider their condition severe enough.
Yeah, I mean, and so
So,
really
yeah.
that's where I got to last year, where I've always snored, and that was sort of brushed off as normal. So my
It's
snoring,
not normal.
not normal. We can say that one
We
more time, Emma and
need
I.
t-shirts.
Yes. Oh, can we please get t-shirts that say
Yeah,
snoring,
we do need
not
to. We
normal?
do need. I've been thinking about it for so long. We just need to
Okay.
do
We'll do a follow-up call on that.
it.
So I was my snoring was getting worse, which again, not normal. Holding my breath more in my sleep. And normally my partner is able to like roll me over. And if I like went onto my side, I would either stop snoring or I'd stop holding my breath. But it was still going when it was on my side. And then so I talked to my sleep doctor about it. Ended up getting an upper airway resistance syndrome diagnosis. And so now I have a lovely sleep apnea retainer that I sleep in.
So tell us about, because I think a lot of people in the traditional system going to a sleep specialist find it hard to get a diagnosis of upper airway resistance syndrome. So how did that happen? Like, did they just look back at your previous sleep study and actually look to check on, like, what was happening with your airflow and
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a combination of things that he could give me this diagnosis that
yeah.
I have this, in my past. I mean, I have that literally from those tests, but then I also
Yes.
have the regular complaints about snoring. I have all the apps that I've recorded myself sleeping that you can hear how significant my
Yes.
snoring is. And the regular occurrences of my holding my breath, that he felt comfortable giving me that
Yeah.
diagnosis.
And so here's the thing where you're like, you were just in such a beautiful situation because I hear from so many women who are trying to get this diagnosis and some treatment. And they're having a tough time because their sleep specialist doesn't have a relationship with a dentist. Because oftentimes, an oral appliance is, kind of a good therapy for people with upper airway resistance syndrome. But, like, the doctor, like, if somebody's not doing CPAP, some sleep specialists, like, they don't really, they're just kind of like, I suppose you could go and find someone to do an oral appliance, but you're kind of on your own. But what happened with you?
The best thing ever. So it was not until I, needed to get my narcolepsy diagnosis at 35 that I learned that sleep specialists were a thing. So last year I learned that sleep dentists were a thing. I had
Yeah.
no Yeah. And I did not know that my sleep doctor, whom I adore and I've now seen for over 5 years, was married to one.
Was married to one.
So my sleep doctor and my sleep dentist are married, which I think is like the best thing in the entire world. And she's awesome. Yeah, got me on my way with the oral appliance that I did not know was a thing either, because I'm like the worst teeth grinder. I chipped two fillings, like I popped fillings off last year grinding my teeth, which has always just been blamed on stress. And did not know that this was also a symptom of upper airways resistance syndrome with everything else. Because I've been a terrible grinder. I've had TMJ. I got diagnosed with TMJ like as a young teenager.
And so how has that been with the oral appliance? Because I know that sometimes that's one thing people have a tough time with. If they do have an existing TMJ issue, sometimes the holding the mandible forward can lead to kind of flare-ups of that. But it's kind of like which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Because for me, I think I'm clenching and grinding less because my airway's more open because I'm doing the oral appliance as well as the CPAP. So I think like for me, like I'm having less issues with TMJ stuff, but for some people it's not that way. So how has that been for you?
My TMJ has actually been much better. Like before my oral appliance, like I couldn't even touch the sides of my face. Like it would hurt. And like now it doesn't feel the same way. I actually, a couple of weeks into
That's
wearing
great, Lindsay. I'm
it,
so
like,
pleased.
oh my God, it's been so much better. A couple of weeks into wearing it, like I would feel these sort of like releases of pressure around my jaw that everything was just sort of starting to release, which has really helped.
And actually relax for the first time in our lives.
Yeah, and it helps my neck, my shoulders, like it's all connected. Also attached to your pelvic floor too. We can do a whole nother episode on the connection between your jaw and your pelvic floor. It's been my world has really changed wearing it. I don't wake up with a sore throat in the morning. I don't snore. I don't hold my breath. And I wake up feeling a lot more rested. And I can actually, with narcolepsy, that sort of feeling of being awake 48 to 72 hours sort of sets in. It doesn't necessarily come the minute you wake up, and so I can actually wake up feeling a lot more rested with my retainer
That's
now
great.
than I did prior to wearing it. So it's really been very helpful. Now, the diagnosis of upper airways resistance syndrome did not help a lot in my case. I was still completely out of pocket on my retainer.
Yes. That's so common for a lot of people. Same with me.
Which is
And
really
it's like also, and I talk to a lot of people where they're looking at, like for me, the combination of the CPAP and the oral appliance together has been really helpful. But my insurance company, like they want to pay for one therapy. So I think that there's a lot of catching up to do, to really reflect what people are dealing with.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's so much education that's needed on this, that if you are feeling crappy and you have had a sleep study and you were told that you were fine, that there could be this sort of diagnosis in the mushy middle there, which I think is sort of like the IBS of like sleep medicine, where, like we've given it a name, like we haven't done a lot of like treatments for it or understand that you can get treatments for it. There definitely needs to be more out there for people on this
I
because,
know that, like, I did an episode with a guy called Ken Hooks, who is a sleep tech, but he will give people kind of second opinions on their raw sleep. Like when they go for a sleep study, people can get all of their data and he'll look at the whole thing and he finds upper airway resistance syndrome in so many women that have been told, you don't have sleep apnea and nothing to see here, go home, but they still have symptoms. So a lot of it is unfortunately really doing the work to advocate for yourself. And if you're not getting anywhere with doctors, find somebody else, like, and get second opinions and keep asking, because it's just like so worth it to be on the other side of it and actually, getting some better sleep.
And I think that's the most important part is the advocacy on that is knowing that just because a general practitioner can refer you for a sleep study doesn't mean that they know how to interpret it and doesn't mean they
Right.
know what to do next.
Right.
And so please, 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 for anyone who is listening to this, who has been in this situation where they've had a sleep study and been told that they're fine and still don't feel like they are, see a sleep specialist.
Yeah.
And not all sleep specialists are created equal. So if you're seeing a sleep
Right.
specialist who is also telling
There
you that
are some, like,
wrong.
I always feel like I have to say this, like, there are some just excellent sleep specialists. Like, I've interviewed some of them, and they're totally amazing. So I'm not dissing on every sleep specialist at all. I just think that, people can be very expert at treating sleep apnea, and this whole idea of these lower AHI but high symptom people, it feels to a lot of sleep specialists as a kind of new area, right? They don't
I mean,
really
they were
have the
taught that sleep apnea is,
right.
overweight,
Yeah,
old
older
men with
men.
a thick,
Yeah.
thick neck and a square jaw.
Yes.
And if
Yeah.
you don't fit that, then this is new to them because
Yeah.
it wasn't what the information was. I mean,
Yeah.
my sister is 5'8" and a size 0, and she has sleep apnea.
Professor's not alone. Like, that's a common thing that I hear all the time.
No, I think that is the. It just it's education on every front, just like every other
Yeah.
thing we combat in the sleep disorder conversation is that we need more education on the patient side. We definitely need more education on the doctor side. But really it's if you don't get the answers that you're looking for, and when I say if you don't get the answer you're looking for, it might not be the diagnosis that you thought you had. I'm one of those people. I missed that
Yeah.
diagnosis. And so what I thought it was not what it was. But if you are not getting answers and you feel terrible, you know your body better than anybody.
Yes.
And you have to honor that. And if your
Yeah.
body is still telling you something's wrong and a medical professional is telling you that nothing is wrong, see another medical professional
Yeah,
because
such great
you are right.
advice. Yeah. And if you're younger than 40 and you haven't don't have the wisdom yet and the ability to say no to people, like, just take it from us, like, go and see some different people. It's okay, you won't get in
Lindsay and
trouble.
Emma told you it was
We
okay.
told you it was fine.
Three, no one should tell you this is what getting older feels like.
Right, ever. Tell us really quick about you were really affected by the shortage of some of the stimulant drugs. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I mean, that's definitely it's still an ongoing issue for a lot of people. I've been very lucky at the pharmacy I ended up working with, but there was started an Adderall shortage last year. A lot of people with sleep disorders take Adderall as well
Yes.
as for people with ADHD. That Adderall shortage started pushing into other stimulants, Ritalin, Vyvanse, Concerta, and as well as there was a drug ruling that certain medications above a threshold were all sort of grouped together. And if a pharmacy was giving out more of those drugs than the general population of their drugs, they got shut down for a period of time. And it wasn't just one pharmacy, it was the company and regionally.
A
If you
lot
went
of people
to a
affected.
CVS in Southern California, you are being affected along with all of the other CVSs in that region. And so a lot of people have been affected by this. For there's already a lot of stigma that goes with stimulants, no matter what you're taking it for.
Yes.
And patients have been put in this place where they're treated like they're drug seeking, and it's been really unfortunate to watch. When I it sort of started slowly with me where the pharmacy, could get it, but it was going to take 8 days. And so I'd be unmedicated for maybe 2 days in this process. And then when it was like, we don't know when we're going to get it again. They were like, you probably need to find another pharmacy. I called 76 pharmacies before I found one that told me that they could order it for me. And I was on the phone with you that day.
And I was gonna say, like, we were saying that day, like, I felt for you so much, but at the same time, we were both saying
This is you who is, making spreadsheets and can call 70 plus pharmacies. What about the people who, like have all sorts of other illnesses they're dealing with and don't, don't have a carer to help them? And it's just been a real mess for a lot of people.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I have to recognize my privilege in that, I work for myself, I work from home. I can spend the time calling the pharmacy and making a spreadsheet and driving the extra 45 minutes to go pick up medication from the pharmacy I found that could get it for me. And not
Yes.
everybody has that. And so you're taking people who need these medications to function and then making it that much harder to get the medication that they need to function. And people have just been in a really nasty cycle for a really long time right
Long
now.
time,
Because
yeah.
it's not just you get the medication and you're fine. I mean, most of these medications you have to get refilled every month. And so you are spending a week dreading that you're not going to be able to get the medication. Then you're spending a
Yeah.
week trying to get the medication. Then maybe you're spending a week unmedicated. And by the time you get back into your body, like you have to catch up on all of that. And that's a cycle
Yeah.
again every month. And I'm very grateful that I found a small family pharmacy that hasn't had an issue.
Oh,
But
well.
there are a lot of people who are still hurting really badly on this.
Thanks very much for sharing about that because I think that there are so many people dealing with that right now, and we need to keep talking about it for sure. So thank you so much for joining me, Lindsay. Do you want to tell everybody where they can find you?
I am really happy sharing a lot of information on Instagram right now. You can find me there at lindsay.scola. You can find me on my website at lindsayscola.com. And just keep watching out for more fun writing projects and
Love
podcasts.
it.
And I'll keep you posted. And I'm very excited for my Snoring Is Not Normal t-shirt.
I know, we've got to get on that. Thanks so much for listening. I love hearing from you. If you'd like to be featured in an upcoming episode, please email me at sleepapneastories@gmail.com. That's also the place to get in touch if you just want to say hi or ask a question. Alternatively, you can always reach me on Instagram. My handle there is @sleepapneastories. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen. This really helps a wider audience to find the episodes, and I really appreciate it.